to remember that these men were the sons of their forefathers. I was then a soldier, and did not wish to meddle in politics, all the more so because the time was inopportune. I still believe that the most modest stable boy of those days served his country better than the best of, let us say, the parliamentary deputies. My hatred for those footlers was never greater than in those days when all decent men who had anything to say said it point blank in the enemy's face, or, failing this, kept their mouths shut and did their duty elsewhere. I despised those political fellows, and if I had had my way, I would have formed them into a Labour battalion and given them the opportunity of babbling amongst themselves to their heart's content, without offence or harm to decent people.
File 36.
In those days I cared nothing for politics, but I could not help forming an opinion on certain manifestations which affected not only the whole nation, but also us soldiers in particular. There were two things which caused me the greatest anxiety at that time, and which I had come to regard as detrimental to our interests. Shortly after our first series of victories, a certain section of the press already began to throw cold water, drip by drip, on the enthusiasm of the public. At first, this was not obvious to many people. It was done under the mask of good intentions and a spirit of anxious care. The public was told that big celebrations of victories were somewhat out of place and were not worthy expressions of the spirit of a great nation. The fortitude and valour of German soldiers were accepted facts which did not necessarily call for outbursts of celebration. Furthermore, it was asked, what would foreign opinion have to say about these manifestations? Would not foreign opinion react more favourably to a quiet and sober form of celebration, rather than to all this wild jubilation? Surely the time had come, so the press declared, for us Germans to remember that this war was not our work, and that hence there need be no feeling of shame in declaring our willingness to do our share towards effecting an understanding among the nations. For this reason it would not be wise to sully the radiant deeds of our army with unbecoming jubilation, for the rest of the world would never understand this. Furthermore, nothing is more appreciated than the modesty with which a true hero quietly and unassumingly carries on and forgets. Such was the gist of their warning. Instead of catching these fellows by their long ears and dragging them to some ditch and looping a cord around their necks, so that the victorious enthusiasm of the nation should no longer offend the aesthetic sensibilities of these knights of the pen, a general press campaign was now allowed to go on against what was called unbecoming and undignified forms of victorious celebration. No one seemed to have the faintest idea that when public enthusiasm is once damped, nothing can enkindle it again when the necessity arises. This enthusiasm is an intoxication and must be kept up in that form. Without the support of this enthusiastic spirit, how would it be possible to endure in a struggle which, according to human standards, made such immense demands on the spiritual stamina of the nation? I was only too well acquainted with the psychology of the broad masses not to know that in such cases a magnanimous aestheticism cannot fan the fire which is needed to keep the iron hot. In my eyes, it was even a mistake not to have tried to raise the pitch of public enthusiasm still higher. Therefore, I could not at all understand why the contrary policy was adopted, that is to say, the policy of damping the public spirit. Another thing which irritated me was the manner in which Marxism was regarded and accepted. I thought that all this proved how little they knew about the Marxist plague. It was believed, in all seriousness, that the abolition of party distinctions during the war had made Marxism a mild and moderate thing. But here there was no question of party. There was a question of a doctrine which was being expounded for the express purpose of leading humanity to its destruction. The purpose of this doctrine was not understood, because nothing was said about that side of the question in our Jew-ridden universities, and because our supercilious bureaucratic officials did not think it worthwhile to read up a subject which had not been prescribed in their university course. This mighty revolutionary trend was going on beside them, but those intellectuals would not deign to give it their attention. That is why state enterprise nearly always lags behind private enterprise. Of these gentry, one can truly say that their maxim is, "What we don't know won't bother us." In the August of 1914, the German worker was looked upon as an adherent of Marxist socialism. That was a gross error. When those fateful hours dawned, the German worker shook off the poisonous clutches of that plague. Otherwise he would not have been so willing and ready to fight. And people were stupid enough to imagine that Marxism had now become national. Another apt illustration of the fact that those in authority had never taken the trouble to study the real tenor of Marxist teaching. If they had done so, such foolish errors would not have been committed. Marxism, whose final objective was, and is, and will continue to be, the destruction of all non-Jewish national states, had to witness in those days of July 1914 how the German working classes, which it had been inveigling, were aroused by the national spirit and rapidly ranged themselves on the side of the fatherland. Within a few days, the deceptive smokescreen of that infamous national betrayal had vanished into thin air, and the Jewish bosses suddenly found themselves alone and deserted. It was as if not a vestige had been left of that folly and madness which the masses of the German people had been inoculated for 60 years. That was indeed an evil day for the betrayers of German labour. The moment, however, that the leaders realised the danger which threatened them, they pulled the magic cap of deceit over their ears, and, without being identified, played the part of mimes in the national reawakening. The time seemed to have arrived for proceeding against the whole Jewish gang of public pests. Then it was that action should have been taken, regardless of any consequent whining or protestation. At one stroke, in the August of 1914, all the empty nonsense about international solidarity was knocked out of the heads of the German working classes. A few weeks later, instead of this stupid talk sounding in their ears, they heard the noise of American-manufactured shrapnel bursting above the heads of the marching columns, as a symbol of international comradeship. Now that the German worker had rediscovered the road to nationhood, it ought to have been the duty of any government which had the care of the people in its keeping to take this opportunity of mercilessly rooting out everything that was opposed to the national spirit. While the flower of the nation's manhood was dying at the front, there was time enough at home, at least, to exterminate this vermin. But instead of doing so, His Majesty the Kaiser held out his hand to these hoary criminals, thus assuring them his protection and allowing them to regain their mental composure. And so the viper could begin his work again. This time, however, more carefully than before, but still more destructively. While honest people dreamt of reconciliation, these perjured criminals were making preparations for a revolution. Naturally, I was distressed at the half-measures which were adopted at that time, but I never thought it possible that the final consequences could have been so disastrous. But what should have been done then? Throw the ringleaders into jail, prosecute them, and rid the nation of them? Uncompromising military measures should have been adopted to root out the evil. Parties should have been abolished, and the Reichstag brought to its senses at the point of the bayonet if necessary. It would have been still better if the Reichstag had been dissolved immediately. Just as the Republic today dissolves the parties when it wants to, so in those days there was even more justification for applying that measure, seeing that the very existence of the nation was at stake. Of course, this suggestion would give rise to the question, is it possible to eradicate ideas by force of arms? Could a Weltanschauung be attacked by means of physical force? At that time I turned these questions over and over again in my mind. By studying analogous cases exemplified in history, particularly those which had arisen from religious circumstances, I came to the following fundamental conclusion. Ideas and philosophical systems, as well as movements grounded on a definite spiritual foundation, whether true or not, can never be broken by the use of force after a certain stage, except on one condition, namely, that this use of force is in the service of a new idea, or Weltanschauung, which burns with a new flame. The application of force alone, without moral support based on a spiritual concept, can never bring about the destruction of an idea or arrest the propagation of it, unless one is ready and able ruthlessly to exterminate the last upholders of that idea, even to a man, and also wipe out any tradition which it may tend to leave behind. Now, in the majority of cases, the result of such a course has been to exclude such a state, either temporarily or forever, from the comity of states that are of political significance. But experience has also shown that such a sanguinary method of extirpation arouses the better section of the population under the persecuting power. As a matter of fact, every persecution which has no spiritual motives to support it is morally unjust and raises opposition amongst the best elements of the population. So much so that these are driven more and more to champion the ideas that are unjustly persecuted. With many individuals, this arises from the sheer spirit of opposition to every attempt at suppressing spiritual things by brute force. In this way, the number of convinced adherents of the persecuted doctrine increases as the persecution progresses. Hence, the total destruction of a new doctrine can be accomplished only by a vast plan of extermination. But this, in the final analysis, means the loss of some of the best blood in a nation or state. And that blood is then avenged, because such an internal and total clean-up brings about the collapse of the nation's strength. And such a procedure is always condemned to futility from the very start, if the attack doctrine should happen to have spread beyond a small circle. That is why, in this case, as with all other growths, the doctrine can be exterminated in its earliest stages. As time goes on, its powers of resistance increase, until at the approach of age it gives way to younger elements, but under another form and from other motives.
File 37.
The fact remains that nearly all attempts to exterminate a doctrine, without having some spiritual basis of attack against it, and also to wipe out all the organizations it has created, have led in many cases to the very opposite being achieved, and that for the following reasons. When sheer force is used to combat the spread of a doctrine, then that force must be employed systematically and persistently. This means that the chances of success in the suppression of a doctrine lie only in the persistent and uniform application of the methods chosen. The moment hesitation is shown, and periods of tolerance alternate with the application of force, the doctrine against which these measures are directed will not only recover strength, but every successive persecution will bring to its support new adherents who have been shocked by the oppressive methods employed. The old adherents will become more embittered, and their allegiance will thereby be strengthened. Therefore, when force is employed, success is dependent on the consistent manner in which it is used. This persistence, however, is nothing less than the product of definite spiritual convictions. Every form of force that is not supported by a spiritual backing will be always indecisive and uncertain. Such a force lacks the stability that can be found only in a Weltanschauung which has devoted champions. Such a force is the expression of the individual energies. Therefore, it is, from time to time, dependent on the change of persons in whose hands it is employed, and also on their characters and capacities. But there is something else to be said. Every Weltanschauung, whether religious or political, and it is sometimes difficult to say whether one ends and the other begins, fights not so much for the negative destruction of the opposing world of ideas as for the positive realization of its own ideas. Thus its struggle lies in attack rather than in defense. It has the advantage of knowing where its objective lies, as this objective represents the realization of its own ideas. Inversely, it is difficult to say when the negative aim for the destruction of a hostile doctrine is reached and secured. For this reason alone, a Weltanschauung which is of an aggressive character is more definite in plan and more powerful and decisive in action than a Weltanschauung which takes up a merely defensive attitude. If force be used to combat a spiritual power, that force remains a defensive measure only so long as the wielders of it are not the standard-bearers and apostles of a new spiritual doctrine. To sum up, the following must be borne in mind: that every attempt to combat a Weltanschauung by means of force will turn out futile in the end if the struggle fails to take the form of an offensive for the establishment of an entirely new spiritual order of things. It is only in the struggle between two Weltanschauungen that physical force, consistently and ruthlessly applied, will eventually turn the scales in its own favour. It was here that the fight against Marxism had hitherto failed. This was also the reason why Bismarck's anti-socialist legislation failed, and was bound to fail in the long run, despite everything. It lacked the basis of a new Weltanschauung for whose development and extension the struggle might have been taken up. To say that the serving up of drivel about a so-called state authority or law and order was an adequate foundation for the spiritual driving force in a life-or-death struggle is only what one would expect to hear from the wiseacres in high official positions. It was because there were no adequate spiritual motives back of this offensive that Bismarck was compelled to hand over the administration of his socialist legislative measures to the judgment and approval of those circles which were themselves the product of the Marxist teaching. Thus, a very ludicrous state of affairs prevailed when the Iron Chancellor surrendered the fate of his struggle against Marxism to the goodwill of the bourgeois democracy. He left the goat to take care of the garden. But this was only the necessary result of the failure to find a fundamentally new Weltanschauung, which would attract devoted champions to its cause and could be established on the ground from which Marxism had been driven out. And thus the result of the Bismarckian campaign was deplorable. During the World War, or at the beginning of it, were the conditions any different? Unfortunately, they were not. The more I then pondered over the necessity for a change in the attitude of the executive government towards social democracy as the incorporation of contemporary Marxism, the more I realized the want of a practical substitute for this doctrine. Supposing social democracy were overthrown, what had one to offer the masses in its stead? Not a single movement existed which promised any success in attracting vast numbers of workers who would now be more or less without leaders, and holding these workers in its train. It is nonsensical to imagine that the international fanatic who has just severed his connection with a class party would forthwith join a bourgeois party, or in other words, another class organization. For however unsatisfactory these various organizations may appear to be, it cannot be denied that bourgeois politicians look on the distinction between classes as a very important factor in social life, provided it does not turn out politically disadvantageous to them. If they deny this fact, they show themselves not only impudent, but also mendacious. Generally speaking, one should guard against considering the broad masses more stupid than they really are. In political matters, it frequently happens that feeling judges more correctly than intellect. But the opinion that this feeling on the part of the masses is sufficient proof of their stupid international attitude can be immediately and definitely refuted by the simple fact that pacifist democracy is no less fatuous, though it draws its supporters almost exclusively from bourgeois circles. As long as millions of citizens daily gulp down what the social democratic press tells them, it ill becomes the masters to joke at the expense of the comrades. For in the long run they all swallow the same hash, even though it be dished up with different spices. In both cases the cook is one and the same, the Jew. One should be careful about contradicting established facts. It is an undeniable fact that the class question has nothing to do with questions concerning ideals, though that dope is administered at election time. Class arrogance among a large section of our people, as well as a prevailing tendency to look down on the manual labourer, are obvious facts, and not the fancies of some daydreamer. Nevertheless, it only illustrates the mentality of our so-called intellectual circles, that they have not yet grasped the fact that circumstances which are capable of preventing the growth of such a plague as Marxism are certainly not capable of restoring what has been lost. The bourgeois parties, a name coined by themselves, will never again be able to win over and hold the proletarian masses in their train. That is because two worlds stand opposed to one another here, in part naturally and in part artificially divided. These two camps have one leading thought, and that is that they must fight one another. But in such a fight, the younger will come off victorious, and that is Marxism. In 1914, a fight against social democracy was indeed quite conceivable. But the lack of any practical substitute made it doubtful how long the fight could be kept up. In this respect, there was a gaping void. Long before the war, I was of the same opinion, and that was the reason why I could not decide to join any of the parties then existing. During the course of the World War, my conviction was still further confirmed by the manifest impossibility of fighting social democracy in anything like a thorough way, because for that purpose there should have been a movement that was something more than a mere parliamentary party, and there was none such. I frequently discussed that want with my intimate comrades, and it was then that I first conceived the idea of taking up political work later on. As I have often assured my friends, it was just this that induced me to become active on the public hustings after the war, in addition to my professional work. And I am sure that this decision was arrived at after much earnest thought.
File 38.
Chapter 6. War Propaganda. In watching the course of political events, I was always struck by the active part which propaganda played in them. I saw that it was an instrument which the Marxist socialists knew how to handle in a masterly way, and how to put it to practical uses. Thus I soon came to realize that the right use of propaganda was an art in itself, and that this art was practically unknown to our bourgeois parties. The Christian Socialist Party alone, especially in Luger's time, showed a certain efficiency in the employment of this instrument, and owed much of their success to it. It was during the war, however, that we had the best chance of estimating the tremendous results which could be obtained by a propagandist system properly carried out. Here again, unfortunately, everything was left to the other side, the work done on our side being worse than insignificant. It was the total failure of the whole German system of information, a failure which was perfectly obvious to every soldier, that urged me to consider the problem of propaganda in a comprehensive way. I had ample opportunity to learn a practical lesson in this matter, for unfortunately it was only too well taught us by the enemy. The lack on our side was exploited by the enemy in such an efficient manner that one could say it showed itself as a real work of genius. In that propaganda carried on by the enemy, I found admirable sources of instruction. The lesson to be learned from this had unfortunately no attraction for the geniuses on our own side. They were simply above all such things, too clever to accept any teaching. Anyhow, they did not honestly wish to learn anything. Had we any propaganda at all? Alas, I can reply only in the negative. All that was undertaken in this direction was so utterly inadequate and misconceived from the very beginning that not only did it prove useless, but at times harmful. In substance, it was insufficient. Psychologically, it was all wrong. Anybody who had carefully investigated the German propaganda must have formed that judgment of it. Our people did not seem to be clear even about the primary question itself, whether propaganda is a means or an end. Propaganda is a means, and must, therefore, be judged in relation to the end it is intended to serve. It must be organized in such a way as to be capable of attaining its objective. And as it is quite clear that the importance of the objective may vary from the standpoint of general necessity, the essential internal character of the propaganda must vary accordingly. The cause for which we fought during the war was the noblest and highest that man could strive for. We were fighting for the freedom and independence of our country, for the security of our future welfare, and the honour of the nation. Despite all views to the contrary, this honour does actually exist. Or rather, it will have to exist, for a nation without honour will sooner or later lose its freedom and independence. This is in accordance with the ruling of a higher justice, for a generation of poltroons is not entitled to freedom. He who would be a slave cannot have honour, for such honour would soon become an object of general scorn. Germany was waging war for its very existence. The purpose of its war propaganda should have been to strengthen the fighting spirit in that struggle and help it to victory. But when nations are fighting for their existence on this earth, when the question of to be or not to be has to be answered, then all humane and aesthetic considerations must be set aside, for these ideals do not exist of themselves somewhere in the air, but are the product of man's creative imagination, and disappear when he disappears. Nature knows nothing of them. Moreover, they are characteristic of only a small number of nations, or rather of races, and their value depends on the measure in which they spring from the racial feeling of the latter. Humane and aesthetic ideals will disappear from the inhabited earth when those races disappear which are the creators and standard-bearers of them. All such ideals are only of secondary importance when a nation is struggling for its existence. They must be prevented from entering into the struggle the moment they threaten to weaken the stamina of the nation that is waging war. That is always the only visible effect whereby their place in the struggle is to be judged. In regard to the part played by humane feeling, Moltke stated that in time of war, the essential thing is to get a decision as quickly as possible, and that the most ruthless methods of fighting are at the same time the most humane. When people attempt to answer this reasoning by highfalutin talk about aesthetics, etc., only one answer can be given. It is that the vital questions involved in the struggle of a nation for its existence must not be subordinated to any aesthetic considerations. The yoke of slavery is, and always will, remain the most unpleasant experience that mankind can endure. Do the Schwabing descendants look upon Germany's lot today as aesthetic? Of course, one doesn't discuss such a question with the Jews, because they are the modern inventors of this cultural perfume. Their very existence is an incarnate denial of the beauty of God's image in his creation. Since these ideas of what is beautiful and humane have no place in warfare, they are not to be used as standards of war propaganda. During the war, propaganda was a means to an end, and this end was the struggle for existence of the German nation. Propaganda, therefore, should have been regarded from the standpoint of its utility for that purpose. The most cruel weapons were then the most humane, provided they helped towards a speedier decision, and only those methods were good and beautiful which helped towards securing the dignity and freedom of the nation. Such was the only possible attitude to adopt towards war propaganda in the life-or-death struggle. If those in what are called positions of authority had realized this, there would have been no uncertainty about the form and employment of war propaganda as a weapon, for it is nothing but a weapon, and indeed a most terrifying weapon in the hands of those who know how to use it. The second question of decisive importance is this: to whom should propaganda be made to appeal? To the educated intellectual classes, or to the less intellectual? Propaganda must always address itself to the broad masses of the people. For the intellectual classes, or what are called the intellectual classes today, propaganda is not suited, but only scientific exposition. Propaganda has as little to do with science as an advertisement poster has to do with art, as far as concerns the form in which it presents its message. The art of the advertisement poster consists in the ability of the designer to attract the attention of the crowd through the form and colours he chooses. The advertisement poster announcing an exhibition of art has no other aim than to convince the public of the importance of the exhibition. The better it does that, the better is the art of the poster as such. Being meant accordingly to impress upon the public the meaning of the exposition, the poster can never take the place of the artistic objects displayed in the exposition hall. They are something entirely different. Therefore, those who wish to study the artistic display must study something that is quite different from the poster. Indeed, for that purpose, a mere wandering through the exhibition galleries is of no use. The student of art must carefully and thoroughly study each exhibit in order slowly to form a judicious opinion about it. The situation is the same in regard to what we understand by the word propaganda. The purpose of propaganda is not the personal instruction of the individual, but rather to attract public attention to certain things, the importance of which can be brought home to the masses only by these means. Here, the art of propaganda consists in putting a matter so clearly and forcibly before the minds of the people as to create a general conviction regarding the reality of a certain fact, the necessity of certain things, and the just character of something that is essential. But as this art is not an end in itself, and because its purpose must be exactly that of the advertisement poster, to attract the attention of the masses, and not by any means to dispense individual instructions to those who already have an educated opinion on things, or wish to form such an opinion on grounds of objective study, because that is not the purpose of propaganda, it must appeal to the feelings of the public rather than to their reasoning powers. All propaganda must be presented in a popular form, and must fix its intellectual level so as not to be above the heads of the least intellectual of those to whom it is directed. Thus, its purely intellectual level will have to be that of the lowest mental common denominator among the public it is desired to reach. When there is question of bringing a whole nation within the circle of its influence, as happens in the case of war propaganda, then too much attention cannot be paid to the necessity of avoiding a high level, which presupposes a relatively high degree of intelligence among the public. The more modest the scientific tenor of this propaganda, and the more it is addressed exclusively to public sentiment, the more decisive will be its success. This is the best test of the value of a propaganda, and not the approbation of a small group of intellectuals or artistic people. The art of propaganda consists precisely in being able to awaken the imagination of the public through an appeal to their feelings, in finding the appropriate psychological form that will arrest the attention and appeal to the hearts of the national masses. That this is not understood by those among us whose wits are supposed to have been sharpened to the highest pitch, is only another proof of their vanity or mental inertia. Once we have understood how necessary it is to concentrate the persuasive forces of propaganda on the broad masses of the people, the following lessons result therefrom. That it is a mistake to organize the direct propaganda as if it were a manifold system of scientific instruction. The receptive powers of the masses are very restricted, and their understanding is feeble. On the other hand, they quickly forget. Such being the case, all effective propaganda must be confined to a few bare essentials, and those must be expressed as far as possible in stereotyped formulas. These slogans should be persistently repeated until the very last individual has come to grasp the idea that has been put forward. If this principle be forgotten, and if an attempt be made to be abstract and general, the propaganda will turn out ineffective, for the public will not be able to digest or retain what is offered to them in this way. Therefore, the greater the scope of the message that has to be presented, the more necessary it is for the propaganda to discover that plan of action which is psychologically the most efficient.
File 39.
It was, for example, a fundamental mistake to ridicule the worth of the enemy, as the Austrian and German comic papers made a chief point of doing in their propaganda. The very principle here is a mistaken one, for when they came face to face with the enemy, our soldiers had quite a different impression. Therefore, the mistake had disastrous results. Once the German soldier realized what a tough enemy he had to fight, he felt that he had been deceived by the manufacturers of the information which had been given him. Therefore, instead of strengthening and stimulating his fighting spirit, this information had quite the contrary effect. Finally, he lost heart. On the other hand, British and American war propaganda was psychologically efficient. By picturing the Germans to their own people as barbarians and Huns, they were preparing their soldiers for the horrors of war and safeguarding them against illusions. The most terrific weapons which those soldiers encountered in the field merely confirmed the information that they had already received, and their belief in the truth of the assertions made by their respective governments was accordingly reinforced. Thus their rage and hatred against the infamous foe was increased. The terrible havoc caused by the German weapons of war was only another illustration of the Hunnish brutality of those barbarians. Whereas on the side of the Entente, no time was left the soldiers to meditate on the similar havoc which their own weapons were capable of. Thus, the British soldier was never allowed to feel that the information which he received at home was untrue. Unfortunately, the opposite was the case with the Germans, who finally wound up by rejecting everything from home as pure swindle and humbug. This result was made possible because at home they thought that the work of propaganda could be entrusted to the first ass that came along, braying of his own special talents, and they had no conception of the fact that propaganda demands the most skilled brains that can be found. Thus the German war propaganda afforded us an incomparable example of how the work of enlightenment should not be done, and how such an example was the result of an entire failure to take any psychological considerations whatsoever into account. From the enemy, however, a fund of valuable knowledge could be gained by those who kept their eyes open, whose powers of perception had not yet become sclerotic, and who, during 4.5 years, had to experience the perpetual flood of enemy propaganda. The worst of all was that our people did not understand the very first condition which has to be fulfilled in every kind of propaganda, namely, a systematically one-sided attitude towards every problem that has to be dealt with. In this regard, so many errors were committed, even from the very beginning of the war, that it was justifiable to doubt whether so much folly could be attributed solely to the stupidity of people in higher quarters. What, for example, should we say of a poster which purported to advertise some new brand of soap by insisting on the excellent qualities of the competitive brands? We should naturally shake our heads. And it ought to be just the same in a similar kind of political advertisement. The aim of propaganda is not to try to pass judgment on conflicting rights, giving each its due, but exclusively to emphasize the right which we are asserting. Propaganda must not investigate the truth objectively, and in so far as it is favorable to the other side, present it according to the theoretical rules of justice. Yet it must present only that aspect of the truth which is favorable to its own side. It was a fundamental mistake to discuss the question of who was responsible for the outbreak of war and declare that the sole responsibility could not be attributed to Germany. The sole responsibility should have been laid on the shoulders of the enemy, without any discussion whatsoever. And what was the consequence of these half-measures? The broad masses of the people are not made up of diplomats or professors of public jurisprudence, nor simply of persons who are able to form reasoned judgment in given cases, but a vacillating crowd of human children who are constantly wavering between one idea and another. As soon as our own propaganda made the slightest suggestion that the enemy had a certain amount of justice on his side, then we laid down the basis on which the justice of our own cause could be questioned. The masses are not in a position to discern where the enemy's fault ends and where our own begins. In such a case, they become hesitant and distrustful, especially when the enemy does not make the same mistake, but heaps all the blame on his adversary. Could there be any clearer proof of this than the fact that finally our own people believed what was said by the enemy's propaganda, which was uniform and consistent in its assertions, rather than what our own propaganda said? And that, of course, was increased by the mania for objectivity which addicts our people. Everybody began to be careful about doing an injustice to the enemy, even at the cost of seriously injuring and even ruining his own people and state. Naturally, the masses were not conscious of the fact that those in authority had failed to study the subject from this angle. The great majority of a nation is so feminine in its character and outlook that its thought and conduct are ruled by sentiment rather than by sober reasoning. This sentiment, however, is not complex, but simple and consistent. It is not highly differentiated, but has only the negative and positive notions of love and hatred, right and wrong, truth and falsehood. Its notions are never partly this and partly that. English propaganda especially understood this in a marvellous way, and put what they understood into practice. They allowed no half-measures which might have given rise to some doubt. Proof of how brilliantly they understood that the feeling of the masses is something primitive was shown in their policy of publishing tales of horror and outrages which fitted in with the real horrors of the time, thereby cleverly and ruthlessly preparing the ground for moral solidarity at the front, even in times of great defeats. Further, the way in which they pilloried the German enemy as solely responsible for the war, which was a brutal and absolute falsehood, and the way in which they proclaimed his guilt, was excellently calculated to reach the masses, realizing that these are always extremist in their feelings. And thus it was that this atrocious lie was positively believed. The effectiveness of this kind of propaganda is well illustrated by the fact that after 4.5 years, not only was the enemy still carrying on his propagandist work, but it was already undermining the stamina of our people at home. That our propaganda did not achieve similar results is not to be wondered at, because it had the germs of inefficiency lodged in its very being by reason of its ambiguity. And because of the very nature of its content, one could not expect it to make the necessary impression on the masses. Only our feckless statesmen could have imagined that on pacifist slops of such a kind the enthusiasm could be nourished which is necessary to enkindle that spirit which leads men to die for their country. And so this product of ours was not only worthless, but detrimental. no matter what an amount of talent employed in the organization of propaganda, it will have no result if due account is not taken of these fundamental principles. Propaganda must be limited to a few simple themes, and these must be represented again and again. Here, as in innumerable other cases, perseverance is the first and most important condition of success. Particularly in the field of propaganda, placid aesthetes and blasé intellectuals should never be allowed to take the lead. The former would readily transform the impressive character of real propaganda into something suitable only for literary tea parties. As to the second class of people, one must always beware of this pest, for in consequence of their insensibility to normal impressions, they are constantly seeking new excitements. Such people grow sick and tired of everything. They always long for change, and will always be incapable of putting themselves in the position of picturing the wants of their less callous fellow creatures in their immediate neighbourhood, let alone trying to understand them. The blasé intellectuals are always the first to criticise propaganda, or rather its message, because this appears to them to be outmoded and trivial. They are always looking for something new, always yearning for change. And thus they become the mortal enemies of every effort that may be made to influence the masses in an effective way. The moment the organization and message of a propagandist movement begins to be orientated according to their tastes, it becomes incoherent and scattered. It is not the purpose of propaganda to create a series of alterations in sentiment with a view to pleasing these blasé gentry. Its chief function is to convince the masses, whose slowness of understanding needs to be given time in order that they may absorb information. And only constant repetition will finally succeed in imprinting an idea on the memory of the crowd. Every change that is made in the subject of a propagandist message must always emphasize the same conclusion. The leading slogan must, of course, be illustrated in many ways and from several angles. But in the end, one must always return to the assertion of the same formula. In this way alone can propaganda be consistent and dynamic in its effect. Only by following these general lines and sticking to them steadfastly, with uniform and concise emphasis, can final success be reached. Then one will be rewarded by the surprising and almost incredible results that such a persistent policy secures. The success of any advertisement, whether of a business or political nature, depends on the consistency and perseverance with which it is employed. In this respect also, the propaganda organized by our enemies set us an excellent example. It confined itself to a few themes, which were meant exclusively for mass consumption, and it repeated these themes with untiring perseverance. Once these fundamental themes and the manner of placing them before the world were recognized as effective, they adhered to them without the slightest alteration for the whole duration of the war. At first, all of it appeared to be idiotic in its impudent assertiveness. Later on, it was looked upon as disturbing. But finally, it was believed. But in England they came to understand something further, namely, that the possibility of success in the use of this spiritual weapon consists in the mass employment of it, and that when employed in this way, it brings full returns for the large expenses incurred. In England, propaganda was regarded as a weapon of the first order, whereas with us, it represented the last hope of a livelihood for our unemployed politicians and a snug job for shirkers of the modest hero type. Taken all in all, its results were negative.